everyone, and welcome to another episode of Our Extraordinary Stories. My name is Dr. Devika Patel, and I'm the host of this podcast. I am an NHS junior doctor specialising in psychiatry, so that means I help and support people with mental illness from their point of crisis and diagnosis right through to recovery. So on today's podcast, I have a very special guest. This podcast is all about exploring that whole mental health spectrum, going from a mental health crisis, mental health illness, all the way up to recovery and a state of human flourishing. I believe that at any point in our lives, we are on one part of the spectrum and it isn't an all or nothing game. If you have a mental illness diagnosis, that is not something that stays with you for your whole life. You will go through periods of remission, you will have points where you are thriving, and there will be parts where you will be just about surviving. And that's the journey that we follow today with our guest, Panisha. So on this podcast, I generally have people with lived experience of mental health difficulties. And then I also try to bring on people that work within the mental health sector. And today's guest, Panisha, actually does both. And I think the reason that she does the job that she does and is able to do it so well and has such good insight into it is because of her own lived experience. So when I first started the podcast last year, she was one of the first people to reach out. And that's exactly what I wanted from this podcast. It wasn't about that person with 20K, 50K followers that are already talking about their stories, but to be for everyday people that are just getting on with life and we don't know what their journey has been. And for that journey to inspire you and make you feel like, actually, I can learn so much from this person's story, or I want to share my story with my friends or family so that they don't feel so alone in their journey as well. And Panisha's been really brave and courageous to give us some insights into what she's been through and how she's got through that, through a lot of things she has implemented really by herself rather than from external sources like mental health services, GP and medication, all those things. And that's really what I want to focus on. And we will do that as we get to the latter part of the conversation. But I thought a good place to start would be if you could give us a quick introduction to yourself and maybe a bit about the role that you're doing at the moment.
Hi, so thank you for having me on. So I'm an emotional health and wellbeing practitioner for children and families, and also alongside that I'm a trainee counsellor. So that involves a lot of work with children in schools, parents, communities, and a lot of education around mental health and wellbeing, whether that be low mood, anxieties, it could be friendship issues, it could be sleep hygiene. I'm there to kind of support the children but also the ecosystem around the children. And it's something that I absolutely love doing. It's one of those roles where, you know, when they say that if you love your job, you don't realise you're doing it. When I am in a session with a child or a family, I'd like to say that I'm fully present and there. So yeah, I really, really love what I do.
Amazing. How did you get into that work? Was that kind of something that you've always wanted to do? What was your kind of career journey towards that?
So I'd say I had quite a typical start as a kind of second generation South Asian girl. So we were told to go to school, get good grades, go to university. But I couldn't really figure out what I wanted to do. I just knew that I was quite creative. I liked people. I liked talking. And naturally, a careers advisor said to me, you need to go into marketing. So that's what I did. I mean, to the people out there that do marketing, it's a brilliant job. It's just I'd spent 6 years in it and I realized it wasn't for me, because it was for me it was getting people to buy something or to be evoked in something as opposed to care. So I got involved with doing some voluntary work for one of the mental health charities in the UK, Mind, and then I made a kind of bold move against many people's wishes in kind of my early 20s, mid-20s, to then change career.
Wow.
I took a big pay cut, moved location, and I haven't really looked back, but I've gone on a journey within mental health. So I've worked with the elderly with Alzheimer's dementia in care homes. I've done mental health work in kind of units and hospitalised facilities, and then moved to children. And when it moved to children and families, the glove fit. So I was I just felt so at peace with it, and that was what I was meant to do. And, you know, I haven't looked back. One of the reasons that I probably could add in here is my story as a child is that my parents divorced or split up when I was young. It wasn't necessarily for differences. When I look back at the narrative, it's because my mum had what I look back on now as postnatal psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
So she was unable to care for me.
Mm-hmm.
So from a very young age, my father looked after me and my grandmother. But it always confused me because a lot of children in my generation, maybe not in my culture, but from other cultures, would live, if they were in a split situation, more often than not, with their mums.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is something that I questioned a lot, and the answers, and it's through no fault of the community, I understand that it was just a mindset back in the 80s, was that mental health wasn't talked about or discussed. So for many years, I was told that my mum had just left me. And then other people would say, oh, she's, you know, in Gujarati, there's a term, Harry, which just mm-hmm. is, you know, the overriding umbrella term for there's something wrong in her head. And upon visiting her in holidays and things like that, I wasn't quite sure what people meant, because sometimes she presented okay and some she just presented as a bit peculiar. So I think it was that journey that made me then look at what was going on in my life. And I wanted to understand mental health a little bit more, because there were signs in me and my thinking that were troubling me. Just a lot of low mood and low self-worth and really dark thoughts, really, from a young age.
Yeah. When you say young age, when do you remember kind of feeling like this doesn't feel quite right? And even that is actually quite hard, because if you've always felt a certain way,
yeah,
even just working out like this is different yeah. to my friends. So just talk a little bit to that point. You could.
I'd say probably the start of secondary school.
Mm-hmm. So a big transition anyway in life.
Yeah, and I started having some behaviours, and I'm gonna put this out here because not many people know about this, but I had an OCD, as yeah. it was, never diagnosed by the doctors, but I know what it is now. Mm-hmm. Is I used to subconsciously pull out my hair to the extent that I had bald spots. And I would cover them up with, you know, black eyeliner. Yeah. And now I know it's a condition called trichotillomania that,
mm-hmm.
you know, may be managed. But I knew that at those times my thoughts would, you know, I'd be so hyper-focused on becoming this blend of what society or culture expected of me. And I also wanted to almost fix my past. And, you know, I know this is someone in their mid-30s, you know, I was going, okay, this has happened with my family now. Eventually, I'm going to find this perfect man to marry, to have this perfect family to repair, and I need to do that. And that was my focus, and my hormones were changing. Any sign of rejection, I dealt with, you know, in a really unhealthy way.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't dare speak about that, because you didn't then.
Yeah.
So in the end, I think it was in my 20s, early 20s, that I came into contact with mental health services
mm-hmm.
following a breakdown of what I deemed to be this perfect, significant relationship, in my mind anyway. And the breakdown of that relationship, and relationships in general, whether that be friendships or romantic relationships mm-hmm. or family relationships, you know, I struggled so much that I didn't want to be here.
Hmm.
And eventually those thoughts took over.
Yeah.
And, you know, looking back, it was down to self-worth and not knowing where I fitted in or how I was supposed to fit in. And I did. I attempted to take my own life. And that naturally triggers the help of mental health services. It triggers some challenging conversations.
Hmm.
And feelings for my family.
Yeah.
Because we've almost just compartmentalized what had happened to Mom.
It almost brought it all back for them, like the thing that they wanted to
and it was almost
hide away.
And it was almost too tidy to say, okay, she's just like her. That's it. She's going to be ill now for the rest of her life. These are the thoughts that she has. But yeah, so that was kind of my, I guess, my childhood life with health, and to, I guess, very early 20s,
So just taking it right back to the beginning, and you spoke about kind of how mental health was perceived in the 80s. And I think we're talking about all cultures. Do you think when you had your breakdown, so we're talking 20 years on, was there a difference in how the family reacted at that point, or maybe even people around you, whether that be friends, family friends, people from other cultures? I just want to know if there was any difference. And obviously you weren't there to witness how your family reacted, but you could put the pieces together to say, okay, it happened, and they just, the best way that they could deal with it, and again, no fault to them, was we got to hide it away because it's too difficult for us to deal with the shame or stigma attached to it. Do you think that's moved on at all, or are we just quite still there?
I think it took a lot of learning. I definitely had friends and other people in my life that supported me. My non-biological mother, my stepmom, who is my mom, she's brought me up since I was 4 years old. And looking back, I think she held a place for me, even though she couldn't quite understand. She held a place for me to hold me. And my grandmother as well. You know, it took a few years after that, but they understood eventually, and I could start having some really honest conversations to kind of say, I'm not feeling right. Or maybe I'd have a panic attack, and they would know that I needed space, or maybe the environment was too much for me at the time, and I was able to have those conversations. I think with my dad, and, you know, God love him, that happened later on, probably in the last 5 years. And that's, you know, completely understandable from my part, because he dealt with a partner with mental health difficulties, and there was a fear and a pain that it probably evoked. And again, if we look at the South Asian community, not everyone, but the stereotype is that our men rarely talk, and that part is so difficult for them. And, you know, if you ever listen to this podcast now, we can have those conversations, and it's incredible. Like, I feel that journey with my dad now, and I feel so proud. I feel so proud as a family of how far we've come in understanding and working with mental health just as a whole, and empathy and sympathy and non-judgment, I think. That there's definitely been progression now, but in the early days, I think it was definitely different to what my mom experienced and has experienced. And what I mean by that is, at the time, from the little bits of the narrative that I got, was that she was showing these signs, and they just dropped her off to a psych ward, and they accepted her, and she was medicated, and that was that, really. And then she was unable to look after me as a baby. And then eventually she went back to her parents and, you know, kind of lived her life, part of her life, with them. And I think there was always a risk when I looked into things, and that was a fear, because I still had in the back of my mind, regardless, that I could fix things by having this nucleus of a family. Regardless of how a partner would treat me, I could just fix things if I had this, you know, one partner, a couple of kids, everything would be fine. But then I had the stigma of this mental health to kind of work through. And also, not only that, when I was dating, let's say, a lot of people in the community would not be ashamed to outrightly ask the question of how crazy was your mum, and if I was dating their son, the question was, how do I know you're not that crazy too?
Wow. So like 20 years on.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though my life has taken a completely different narrative, you know, yeah. as we'll probably talk about later about medication and self-care and well-being and I guess the journey that I'm on and the role that I do is very different to where my mum has been and what she's accessed. But her stigma followed me around for a long time.
Yeah. And the difficulties that you both had, yes, it's difficulties with your emotional and mental health, but they're very different in that you didn't experience a psychotic episode and she did. Yeah. And they're both, the causes are very different. The treatments are very different. Outcomes, prognosis, very different too. But that lack of real understanding and the lack of wanting to actually have a mature conversation about it in the community, which comes from a place of compassion and understanding, meant that people are just putting you both under the same umbrella and letting that stigma kind of continue because they're sharing it with their family. And like asking that question, because I always talk about this podcast, it should help us ask questions and have conversations.
Yeah.
But that's like a conversation based on gossip and based on kind of comes from a negative place with no good intention attached to it, to actually understand more about the person, the suffering that they may have gone through as a family or anything like that. Yeah. So kind of very ill-meaning. But what I'm really happy to hear about is how you speak about your family and the journey that you've been on. Because I think even in our mental health services, sometimes we forget about, I really like the word you used, ecosystem, and what's happening around the patient. Because actually, if you look at what's happening around the patient, that will tell you exactly why something has happened when it's happened and why someone may not be progressing as you expect them to as well. And it is a journey that everyone has to go on together. When mental ill health or difficulty with emotion hits someone, there's a ripple effect to the rest of the family as well, and everyone is impacted. And it requires everyone to kind of come together and give each other that space to say, I feel this way, but I don't want you to panic. I'm telling you so that you can help me and support me, and I'll tell you what support I need. And it's been amazing. I think you would have had a lot to do with that because you were willing to have those conversations with your family, even though you knew they were going to be difficult and there was a chance that they were going to shut them right down, but you kind of persisted with it.
Yeah.
And then they were able to learn from you what you need. And now everyone can kind of grow together. It sounds like you've also given your dad the space to talk about how has felt in the past, how he's feeling now.
Yeah.
By showing your vulnerability, which is amazing. I want to ask a little bit more about your interaction with mental health services.
Yeah.
Again, something that frustrates me is that there's lots of information on Instagram and people will say things like, I suffer with anxiety, I suffer with depression, but there's not the kind of intricate information of actually when you do have these difficulties, where do you actually go for help? How does that help come to you? How do you interact with the services? What actual help do you get? How do you feel on the receiving end? I'm on the end where I'm giving the help. And again, I find that I only get like tip of the iceberg from the patient. The patient sometimes will tell me what I know I want to hear. So I never get that other side of, well, actually, was that service even helpful for you? Or did we actually make things worse for you at that time? So could you talk through your experiences of the mental health services, how it began for you? Was it via the GP initially? Was it through counselling? Or was it actually through kind of you went straight into secondary care mental health services because of the risks that you were presenting with?
I think that first attempt triggered the crisis teams and the mental health services. And then when this significant relationship broke down and I had the stigma and I was ashamed and I moved far away. I moved quite away because I didn't want my family to see me in that state.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd also started working for Mind And I was able at that point to be quite transparent with my manager.
Yeah.
And actually that was the turning point for me, because then I accessed some psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting. But there were some parts that maybe didn't work for me.
Yeah.
And I was in a place of work that were supporting me, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
That was the turning point for me, really. And then, you know, alongside that, trying to help others, work with others. And it was seeing someone to talk to.
Yeah.
But then I started on a journey where I went to my first ever mindfulness session. And I remember it was out in this place called the New Forest.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just told to walk. And I paid £10 for this session. And I remember thinking, this lady is just making us walk. We're going to walk outside in the forest for 15 minutes. And then we're going to walk inside in this old school hall. I don't understand what's going on.
Yeah.
But I remember being intrigued. I remember being intrigued, and I remember getting such good energy. I was the youngest in the room,
mm-hmm.
by far. And it kind of took me on this journey, so that as I continued seeing a psychiatrist, eventually I went on to see a counsellor.
Mm-hmm.
And I was offered some medication to help, yeah. kind of regulate my low mood.
Mm-hmm.
Because at this point I'd already had an attempt, and I was still feeling that low that I didn't, yeah. feel I was adding any value to anything on earth. And I always have this message that I say to people who may not know my story, and I won't divulge it, when they talk, mm-hmm. about suicide or the act of it being selfish, or they should have done this and they should have done that. I can say from my own lived experience, you cannot describe the pain and despair you are feeling, and you do not know at that point any way to rid yourself of the pain.
Yeah.
And actually sometimes, you know, I definitely did. I felt as though I was taking away more from people's lives than I was adding.
Mm.
I was in that place for a long time inside. I masked it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I masked it, and the masking and the energy that I would have out in public made the psychiatrist question whether I had emotionally unstable personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
When he mentioned that,
yeah.
it was only actually, Devika, in the last 12 months that I took that label away. I didn't actually have that official label.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As soon as it was said to me, I thought that was the easiest way to make people understand.
Yeah.
So I took the label on, mm-hmm. to make things tidier for myself. I think mental health and services, they need to have a lot more feedback. But as I mentioned before, an ecosystem, and this something that we do in the services that we provide, which is what we call a whole school approach, or we, mm-hmm. call it an ecosystem approach. It's about looking at that person at the present moment, okay, but not forgetting their journey, not forgetting their life,
yeah.
and their life around it, whether that's their culture, whether that's their community, whether it's peer pressure, you know, when I'm working with children, whether it's a divide in poverty and wealth, what are they facing? You know, you'll have come across it just as much as I have, you know, post-pandemic.
Yeah.
There are so many more layers to look at. And I think mental health services really need to look at it as a whole approach. And when I say a whole approach, as much as I said work supported me, that is so important.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that has supported me through my life, including when I had my breakdown, peer support. And the simplest way I can describe this to people is, okay, we can take one life change, for example. So yeah. people in marriages might relate to other people in marriages. Mm-hmm. It's a, yeah. bit of peer support. People that have had a child, a young child or a young baby, are naturally drawn to people because they're going through a similar life stage, and they can,
yes.
talk about those things. As much as no other individual can ever feel the exact way you do, just knowing that someone has felt something, even with an inkling of similarity, is a great relief, because, mm. when you are feeling low or you have a major depressive episode or you are so anxious that, you know, you are unable to leave the house or you're having all these other maybe issues because of the anxiety, whether it's issues or sleep or OCDs that come from some of these issues. It's just alongside professionals. Sometimes you need a space to talk with people that have been people that have lived lives, which is, again, the beauty of this podcast, is it people with lived experiences. And for me, that's another thing that helped me with work. I had a supportive manager, but actually a lot in mind, we were encouraged that a lot of people that applied for roles had a bit of lived experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had like a peer support team. And so people could almost be their authentic selves in a workplace. Yes, there were expectations, but you had someone to talk to that didn't have an official title of counsellor, psychiatrist.
And it was like there's, like, I do find with patients, and it's really hard because I'll never be able to break down this barrier, because as soon as they walk into the room, I'm Dr. Patel, I'm the psychiatrist.
Yeah.
But trying to get them to talk to me just just like a human to human level.
Yeah.
Just like, how is life treating you? And that exchange can only happen if it's two way. And that's what you're getting with your peer support. Because in my appointments, very one way. I'm going to ask you the questions. You're going to answer them. And based on the answers you give me, that's going to decide what treatment you get, whether you're going to be discharged, whether we keep you on, how quickly I follow you up, whether you get admitted. So there's always an agenda with my appointments. There's always got to be an agenda. And if I get to a point where I'm finding myself just having a chat and there is an agenda, then I have to question, there's a long waiting list and I can't really have this patient on my caseload and it's for discharge. So what that I feel that peer support gives, it's like a conversation without expectations, with no agenda. Yeah. You be you, I'll be me, and we can just have an honest conversation about the things that we've been through.
Yeah.
And sometimes there'll be more listening from one person, but you know that you're not going to be like penalized for feeling a certain way. It's not going to lead to a certain action or anything like that. And I'm a big advocate for peer support workers, and we lost a lot of them when they had the mental health cuts.
Yeah.
They just got rid of them and we hardly have any. But where the few teams remaining, they do have them, and in the psychosis teams, they have them. I find that they're the staff members that know the patients the best. And when things go wrong, we'll know from those staff members. And when solutions need to be found, it's again those staff members that will help. So I do think we're missing like the biggest trick in mental health services by not having as many peer support workers.
Yeah.
Because it's just that sharing of the experience, like you said, you don't feel alone in it, you don't feel judged or penalized for feeling a certain way, and that in itself is just therapeutic.
Yeah,
it doesn't require much more.
Exactly. And I think, you know, people out there, yes, there has been cuts, you're right, and it's all across the board, but I think there are some charities out there that are still, I know that Mind and, you know, other local charities. And it is about one service, hopefully encouraging that other service. And, you know, we could maybe talk about it later. I'm not always the biggest fan of social media. I think it has its pros and its cons. Mm-hmm. But from a personal side, I mean, if you ask someone, here's a link to a video about what peer support is, to see a face, to see someone's expressions, to just feel less isolated in that moment could just turn things. It definitely did for me. And, you know, in terms of my mental health recovery toolkit, it just added to that.
Yeah. And it does look like your recovery was very holistic. I'm not sure if that was you were at the right place at the right time, or it was intentional, but you were able to kind of use all the different sources. So you had your psychiatrist who was, and that's the thing, they're going to want to look for a diagnosis and give a diagnosis. Yeah. Like you said, that expression of making it neat and tidy. we're all about, okay, what terminology can we put on these file of notes so that when someone else comes and sees this patient, they can understand what we're talking for. And when I think about diagnosis, that's the best way I like to think about it, because they are too neat and tidy to explain our complex situations and the individual's actual situation. But so much focus can be put on that diagnosis, but then also the stigma that follows that diagnosis as well. Like, I'm not a fan of the actual naming of that disorder, so emotionally unstable personality disorder. If someone told me that my personality was disordered, I would just think, okay, well, that's it, isn't it? Because if my personality is disordered,
yeah,
how does one change their personality?
It just insinuates chaos.
Like, yeah, like this is what I am, and I'm going to remain this way, and I'm just a broken person. It just kind of
felt, and yeah. I thought it's just easier to just, because it was hard. It was hard for my family because I presented well.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we're going down the clinical route, so I did try medication in my 20s. Now, and this is a disclaimer, I am not against medication. I'm on a whole system approach. But for me, my stigma came from the fact that I'd seen my biological mother heavily medicated without an ecosystem of support. So when they offered me antidepressants and things like that, I was very hesitant.
Yeah.
So I remember trying something, and I'd only tried it for like 3 weeks, and I was having some side effects. And I came back and I said, I don't want to take these anymore. And he's like, they take 6 weeks to start in the system. And I was like, I can't do it. I can't do it to my body. And again, it was my block because of a trauma that I had experienced with my mother. And I was looking at my future saying, you know, I don't want to be dependent on these. And, you know, but then I looked two other things, and I took maybe a couple of sleep aids. But equally so, I know people where talking therapies alongside medication, alongside lots of different things, have worked for them.
Yeah.
But for me, I had a stigma attached. The stigma attached was because of what I'd seen, what I'd witnessed. And to me, it looked like weakness, but it's not a weakness. I completely know that it's not a weakness.
Okay, so you've spoken about being offered the medication, and for your own personal reasons, the side effects, the stigma that you had attached to medication because of your mother's experiences kind of leads to the decision, actually, I don't think medication is for me. And as a psychiatrist, even though my role is to diagnose and give medication, that is the main reason that you would see me in clinic, I am very much also of the same thoughts that actually medication is not for everyone and for every condition. And just kind of, I think it has become more popular. There was a campaign to reduce the stigma of taking medication, but it might have done the opposite, I think, that people think medication is the only way. And I think what you showed in your journey is that medication may or may not be part of your plan, but it, like I said, it's part of the plan. It's not the entirety of it. So for you, you gave it a go, not for you. How did you move forward with your recovery?
Okay, so I remember that conversation with my psychiatrist, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I really think you need to try something else. And I said, I am going to try something else. And I decided to obviously go down this route of mindfulness and well-being. Now, again, you know, I mentioned it before, at the time I was working for Mind, and we had lots of different types of therapy and approaches. So there was group therapy, there was holistic therapies involved in nature, in animals, in gardening. And then I started doing journaling. Now, I've always written diaries. As a young girl, I loved those little diaries, filofaxes. Like, I haven't thrown any away. I mean, sometimes I do it religiously for an amount of time. Sometimes there'd be a significant amount of time passed, but I've always loved writing. So that part came naturally to me. And that started to help alongside these other avenues. I've never really been a sporty person per se. Again, a confidence issue from my part, but I like to be active. So I am by no means a yoga expert.
Mm-hmm.
But if I could choose my two activities that help my mental health, that are physical, I'd say yoga and walking. And when I say walking, I mean mindful walking. The thing I laughed at right at the start.
Yeah.
I mean, where I live, there are some beautiful walks and hills, and I go without headphones. I try as much as I can to have my phone on, you know, silent or airplane mode, because I realize it's my time to engage. And what mindfulness teaches you is, without judgment, just kind of bringing back your thoughts to the present moment. You know, I remember one of the first activities was just to apply a mindfulness concept to looking at your hand. No judgment. Don't look at the wrinkles. Don't judge the color. Just explain what you see. And, you know, we're 10 years down the line when it comes to mindfulness and journaling for me. And then I started doing, and at the time there wasn't Instagram, social media detoxes. There was only Facebook at the time, but I remember just used to reactivate and deactivate my account for a bit. And it made so much difference, because I realized that my mind was busy enough.
Mm-hmm.
It had so much going on that I was adding everything else to it. And it was a case of keeping up appearances. So there was that. Then again, because I've worked for these charities, volunteering with people with different needs, volunteering with animals. I mean, in our family, we didn't really have anyone with a dog. Nobody was kind of, we might go to the farm or the zoo once a year, look at them from afar. Like we weren't a very
animal-friendly
family in that way. I remember taking one of my clients to have some kind of horse therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't quite understand what it was. And I said, oh, I want to come along and have a look. And, you know, I've still to this day never ridden a horse, but I find a sense of calm when I'm with them, when I'm feeding them, whether I'm just watching them.
Yeah.
And so helping others without anything to gain from it. So the rule of thumb for me was, volunteer. Obviously I'm telling people about it now, but don't tell anybody about it.
Mm-hmm.
Just do it for you, and really focus on how it feels for you, where it's taking you. And, you know, those things combined with learning about different avenues of mental health, and I don't mean labels, I mean anxiousness, I mean depressive states as opposed to depression. And, you know, even to the extent that I could have some really euphoric moments. And when I was kind of told I may have this EUPD,
mm-hmm.
I was like, this is not good for me. This isn't good for the people around me either. I'm too excitable. I'm taking on too many projects. I'm doing too many things. I'm falling in love so quickly. Like I'm, you know, I need to be more mindful. I need to write down the places that some of these things are coming from, and really looking at them. And I really need to get comfortable and uncomfortable with myself to work through this.
Hmm.
And then, you know, a shift happened in the work that I was doing, and when I eventually kind of ended up working with children and families, and, you know, some have been through some horrific experiences, and I realised to myself at that moment about time. And it's a cliche, yes, time is precious, but the mindfulness helped me that when I was in a session with a child or a family, that might be the only hour that they get that's for themselves, to themselves. So I had to be fully present. I needed to not think, well, I'm going to check my WhatsApp after to see what I'm going to text back. And actually, it's so-and-so's birthday today. I better put a post on my Instagram story and not forget, so they feel loved too, because I'm sure they did one on mine. And this catch up, it's a catch up culture. Like now on WhatsApp, they've got the thing where you can react to a message to check that you've read it and worked it and responded.
It's just so much, isn't there?
Life admin. But sometimes in between the life admin, you've got to live I think, authentically. And I think for me personally, mindfulness, journaling, being really aware of my health. And when I say health, I mean the movement of my body. I mean the movement of my mind. Where is it going? And, you know, mindfulness, and the other one that I've probably got to express a lot is gratitude.
Yeah.
To be grateful and to be empathic is a great trait to have, but sometimes I feel like it's a learned trait. I genuinely feel like I'm more grateful and empathic than I was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was quick to judge.
Yeah. So it's like a skill.
Yeah.
It's like a skill, something that you need to work on. It doesn't...
Yeah. All of these are definitely skills. And, you know, some people can brush it off and say, oh, that kind of stuff's not for me. And that's okay too. I didn't think it was for me. But it's helped me in ways that has changed my family dynamic. It's changed my work ethic. It's changed the way that I'm a parent. It's changed the way that I'm a daughter. Like, it's been so good.
Yeah.
So good for me to have that kind of mental strength and an awareness of kind of what I need to do as Panisha, what helps me. What else can I learn? What else can I add to my toolkit when I'm feeling, and I've always used this phrase, a little bit wobbly or a little bit not quite right.
Mm-hmm.
I'll find that balance again.
Yeah. And what you've said there, you're kind of echoing my thoughts as well, because some people might be listening and thinking, oh, like, yeah, that's not for me. And sometimes we hear this advice from people that on the surface look like well and fine. So you're like, oh yeah, it's all well and good you saying to do mindfulness, but you're not going through a mental health crisis. But by you sharing your story and saying, no, actually I was in that very dark place and this recovery didn't happen overnight, and it wasn't one pill that sorted it out, but lots of different things all together that took time for you to build the skills up so you could practice it and make it second nature, that got you to where you are. I think that really helps people understand it. Because again, I'm just using kind of the examples that I have in clinic, and I will advocate for people to do mindfulness and exercise and start small, so do some journaling, because I really do think that those are the foundations of your well-being. Yes, you've got your medication. Yes, you need to do your trauma-focused CBT. All of that is going to help you with that recovery. But if your foundations are not stable, if you don't even have that awareness of when your mood is in a good place and when you've reached 100 on that anger scale or 100 on that suicidal scale, then it's going to be very difficult you to make that progress, because it's all those, the yoga, the mindfulness and the journaling. I think all three of those, like you've mentioned, build up the awareness, which is key. If you don't know when you're creeping up, when you're like 50% there, 70% not feeling right, but you're only aware of it when it gets to 100%, then it's going to take a lot to bring you down and bring you back. And that a lot might mean a lot of medication. It might mean an inpatient admission. All these things, and actually all those things can end up being traumatic in themselves as well. So what we get stuck in is this vicious cycle. And I try to stress it, but I think again, it just sounds, when someone with lived experience talks about it, it just has that different impact. So I do hope listeners can take that away from this conversation. This isn't someone just talking from their high horse, oh, you should do this because it's good for you. It's someone that's lived it, breathed it, and found the benefits of it. And just on that note as well, the other thing to add, go on.
From what you're saying is, we are taught from an early age to fill up. And, you know, now in the generation that we are, and Livka, you're like me, you know, we grew up with technology, but that came later on, I think. Children, these just people that are growing, we're filled up with so much, and we're taught to keep filling up. Mm-hmm. And it's not about slowing down per se. It it's about living and taking a breath and being. And that's something that's not taught as it should be alongside the busyness and worth and value. Yeah. And, you know, a problem that I seem to come across with families and children is there's just so much there that alongside the so much, there should have been a you are enough. You can just be.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so, you know, people listening, that those things and probably one other thing that changed things for me mentally was sleep.
Mm-hmm.
I am very, very focused on sleep and sleep hygiene. I think it is revolutionary how much not having enough sleep or quality of sleep or sleep environment can change. And you know, for people with conditions, diagnosable conditions, or even a high level of anxiousness, a high level of low mood, it can impact massively. It affects your digestive gut, it affects the way you think, it affects the way you concentrate when you walk, drive, catch the bus, access your memory recall. And I am no professional, I have no doctorate. All I will say from someone who has been there in a dark place in numerous points, and you know, I was pregnant 5 years ago, and there was, you know, I had a whole perinatal mental health team around me and a whole family that was so worried that I was going to get postnatal psychosis. Mm. That fear was there throughout my pregnancy. Everybody was ready to just, you know, I think my dad was ready to lose me as a person.
Yeah.
Because we were told by the teams that there's a high chance that she could get it because her mum had it.
Mm.
But, you know, sleep in all of that changed things for me. I know when I'm not rested. And there's a guilt sometimes to rest in this culture, and I don't know why.
Yeah, massively.
And when I say rest, I'm not judging people that do this, but let's just put the right frame on rest. It is really giving your body, your mind, your soul, your energies a chance to just relax. Yes, you can kind of watch TV or watch a little bit of something, but it is a time to be. And this is where, again, I'm not getting paid anything for saying this about mindfulness. This is where that practice over years and that comfort within yourself can help, because it can help you get that rest. It can help bring it back to the reality of where you are
mm-hmm.
at this present moment.
Could you share some of the simple things you did for your sleep?
For my sleep, so no technology for an hour before bed. And, you know, if you can't do that and use your phone as an alarm, that's fine. I use a clock that has the kind of lights that come on, an alarm clock. I read when I'm wanting, when I'm struggling to fall asleep, and I don't read on a Kindle. I just read a book, a really easy book, nothing too heavy.
Mm-hmm.
I might even read a children's book if I have to. I might pick up Matilda again because I know what's coming next, and it's going to kind of lull me into sleep. And this is something that I say to the children as well, and to parents that are struggling. I try as much as I can to look at my senses. So in order to get me to sleep, and I went through, you know, some tough times in the last 12 months, a hot water bottle would give me warmth.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of making a warm drink, whether that's a warm water or a hot chocolate, whatever it might be. So you're evoking that. If you need to kind of listen to something before you go to sleep, whether it's just some sounds or a little bit of a, you know, a light podcast, or maybe you play an instrument and you want to just evoke that sense of touch. And I guess for me, that's the little things that I'll do. I'll create a sleep routine. It's funny, I have, you know, a young child, nearly five, and, you know, a lot of parents, and I'm the same, we have this routine, right?
Yeah.
Bath, brush your teeth, bit of milk, read a book, bed,
yeah,
kind of thing. We're ready. Got to have these routines. But us as adults, we grow out of it.
Yeah.
And actually, I'd encourage people to grow back into it. Have your thing and mm-hmm. brush your teeth. So I have this thing at the moment where I used to, in a stressful moment, snack a lot at night. And I realised I wasn't sleeping, but then I'd say to myself, I'm hungry. I think I knew that I wasn't. So I would start to brush my teeth at the same time mm-hmm. that my child did. And subconsciously, it just made me not want to eat anything after I brushed my teeth at, you know, 6:45. And it is. For me, it's about implementing that routine. I have the thing where I put my phone onto a black and white mode after a certain mm-hmm. point. So it's kind of not encouraging me. I also glutton for punishment at the moment, but my phone will tell me how many more minutes I've spent, you know, on it.
Yes.
And it evokes that guilt. And then I'm going, oh, so I'm telling people that I don't have time and I'm such a busy mom. But my phone's telling me that I have spent an extra 2 hours on my mm-hmm. phone.
Yeah.
How did I do that? So, yeah, I would probably say evoke a routine that mm-hmm. gives you a sense of enjoyment, but engages some of your senses to signal to your brain that it's ready for you to rest.
Yeah. Ready. I really like that.
Yeah.
That part of using the senses. Because a lot of the things that they do say about sleep hygiene, we're doing that, but by making it personalized to you and choosing, okay, from a smell point of view, I want my nice sleep spray or I want my diffuser on. It just makes it such a nice, mm-hmm. almost like a ritual,
yeah,
which you need to engage in. It's your ritual mm-hmm. that you do every night for yourself and to prepare yourself for that restorative sleep.
Yeah,
sleep hygiene, very underrated. And I was actually, I've got a post in my drafts to put on social media, but it's about the things that you can do before you see a psychiatrist, because I feel like that first appointment,
oh, wow.
there is so much I tell a patient, but I've only got so much time.
Yeah.
And obviously they've probably been waiting like maybe 3 months for this appointment. So what they really want from me, and they've got expectations from me, is, doc, I want a diagnosis and I want you to talk medication. So all these other amazing lifestyle things, which again is so important, and they're the foundation of getting people better, sometimes don't get the airtime that they need. So I really want to push that message that actually, even before you see your psychiatrist, these are all the things that you can do for yourself. So then when you go to that appointment, you can say, well, do you know what? I've started this. This has helped. This hasn't helped. So I need some more support with this and more help with this side of things. And yeah. it's all those simple things like exercise, like you've said about the walking, building awareness, whether that's through mindfulness, yoga, journaling, doing breath work, making sure you have a good morning and evening routine.
Yeah.
Just those very simple things, nutrition, diet, all those things that are the foundation. If they are not there, that recovery is just going to take way longer, because we're working with one thing. I always tell my patients, depending on the condition that I'm dealing with, most of them, the medication is going to do 50%.
Yeah.
And that's maximum, I would say.
And I think the moment they get into that room with you, it is a message. It's a message to say to yourself, I'm ready to help this, and we'll call it a this for now.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're kindly giving yourself that message, then why don't we do what we can to help this a little bit more? That doesn't mean miracles are going to happen overnight. It just means, let me try a little bit somewhere else. Yeah. It doesn't have to be everything at once. It might just be, you know what, I'm going to start these meds and it's going to affect my sleep. And maybe tonight I'm just going to write down how I'm feeling, or I might just make myself a warm drink and just see what's happening to my body now. It's just about, if we're going to try in one area, like get the support, and that's such a great step to take and a strong step, then we do a little bit while we're outside of the kind of psychiatric psychology arena.
Yeah, definitely agree, because all these things are just going to complement each other. So we want to get to, I always kind of try to show it as like, we want to get to 100% recovery. Well, I want to give you the 100% of your treatment plan, but remember, maybe 50%, maybe less than that, is going to be the medication that I give you today. The rest of it, you need to make that up, whether that is by the talking therapies or doing all the other lifestyle advice that I give you, and all of that will work together to get you where you need to be. And it's a shame that within our mental health services that isn't already built in, almost like a pre-appointment or something to help people. And I'm curious to know, do you know the job, that role that you have?
Yeah.
Is it NHS, or is it with Mind, or is it with a charity, or is it with schools, or is it local authority?
It's with a charity, and I think the current role that I'm in is funded by kind of like the council appointing charities to go out and work with.
So it's kind of like third sector charity.
Yeah.
And they're getting the
and again, it is time limited. And I say to the parents when I start, you know, we have a select amount of sessions. What I would encourage is, if, you know, you are struggling, to get some peer support, get some support for yourself. These are strategies that you can use in the home environment. These are strategies that you can use when you are out and about. Mm-hmm. I try to get as much of a picture as I can.
Yeah.
In the weeks, and that's all it is. It's a short-term intervention in the weeks that I am working with these children and families. Mm. Because you want to give people, you know, autonomy. You want to just give, it's like giving them a hand up, and you haven't 100%. Got a step ladder, and you're saying, here, like, this is what you can do. Can you try and get yourself onto that next step now?
Hoping that
it sparked an interest.
100%. We should be the ones that are showing the way, not being the end point, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, we are helping them on their journey, rather than saying, I have the solution and I'm going to hand it over to you right now. Because there's that part about, when you said autonomy, it made me think about encouraging and empowering the patient to take responsibility. Now, when I talk about responsibility, I'm not saying then that means that you are in the situation because of you. There's no blame that I'm putting on the patient. But it is saying, you are more powerful than you think right now. And there is so much more that you can do to help yourself. And I'm here to tell you. And I'm here to educate you on that, so you can take that knowledge away from this appointment and start implementing it. And I've seen some amazing outcomes from the small things that I tell patients to do. And they work alongside, it works brilliantly alongside the medication. So they're getting kind of like double the benefit from it.
Yeah.
Much more than the patient that comes with the expectation that this doctor is going to find the perfect pill that's going to be the perfect fit for me. And what that leads to is very high expectations of what can happen with medication. So then they feel that let down when it doesn't happen, then they feel untreatable, which further adds to their difficulties. And then we get into a very unrealistic position of what we can get from the appointments, and they stay very much stuck in their position.
I think society sometimes at the moment wants things tidier in a box and an answer and some clean lines. And what I would say is, you know, someone that's been there, I accessed psychiatry, I've accessed various mental health services over the last decade and a half. Things probably won't be that tidy. And that's where kind of disappointment comes from. It is about taking those little steps and just working with all the little bits or trying things and see what is you. That ultimately, that's what you're saying, you know, that we are saying to that other person. And I was saying to my psychiatrist, because of my own fears, medication isn't for me. But I knew from my mother, medication was for her. It was just unfortunate that she was in the environment where nobody was offering her all the other little pieces that I got. And actually, I was quite independent, and I am quite independent. And I went off and I'd already said to myself, and I'm going to be honest in this podcast, and, you know, it's a very natural podcast, but I had decided against this medication. And I'd also decided that if I couldn't help myself enough, then I'd had enough. My thoughts weren't going away. My suicidal thoughts were still there. And, I think probably this is something that the audience maybe needs to hear, is a frank picture. Mm. I rejected that. On the base that I wanted to try a mix of things, and luckily it worked. It didn't work overnight. It took a long time.
Yeah, and during that time, you were still battling with the difficult thoughts, the dark thoughts.
Yeah,
I think that's really important. Again, I think it all comes down to a lot about what we aren't taught in school, what conversations we don't have in our home environment. So when we do get into difficult situations in our lives, all comes at once, and then we kind of don't know where to go. And then the only way that we do know is going down the GP route and then accessing help from there. And most likely you will get medication because the waits for psychology are too long. You may access things through charities. You end up in psychiatric services. But along the way, it does become very much things are being done to you rather than you are going into a toolkit, because that toolkit was never there.
Yeah.
Unless someone has helped you or advised you, or you've actually gone out and say, actually, I don't want this route and I want to do it differently, and I'm going to research how I can do things differently.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's a whole, like sometimes I think about my career and I'm like, do I really want to be doing this job? Because there's so many things that I disagree with in the system.
Yeah.
That I don't like the way that I have to practice. I don't like the way the systems are set up. I don't think they fully do. They can sometimes do a disservice to our patients. And that's just because we don't have, it's not just about resources, it's that we're not looking at it in the most holistic way. But yeah. Also treating mental illnesses and improving the mental health of a nation shouldn't be down to one subspecialty within medicine. It's kind of a whole societal view. So kind of the work that you do is amazing, and it needs to be more mainstream, whereas it's in schools that children get taught this, parents get taught this, so that they are well equipped from a young age.
Yeah, it should be a multi-referral. You know, if your GP is your first point of call, their first point of call could be psychiatric services, it could be support services, it could be peer support services, but it should all be done under one umbrella and offered. And actually, even more so, there should be a role out there that when somebody is within this mental health journey, that there is somebody there to say, you know, I understand it's overwhelming. I understand that there's, it feels like there's so much there. You know, let's take it together piece by piece.
Yeah.
Explain to you. I can show you what peer support looks like. I can show you what support groups are available. You could just sit and listen, or you could join a Zoom call and have your mic and your camera off and just listen.
Yeah.
Those are often, when I speak to people, the turning point.
Yeah. And it reminds me of something, a thought that I had right at the start of our conversation, actually. So it's coming around really nice full circle, because we talk about peer support and we're talking about roles, and these might be through charities, but they're like official roles. Whereas when we think about our South Asian culture, we are really lucky that we still have communities.
Yeah.
So people that will meet regularly, whether that's at weddings or at the temple, at festivals.
Yeah.
And really, these are the places that we can create these peer support groups.
Yeah.
Where we can say, actually, as a community, we have people that have difficulties with their mental health. So we're going to create a safe space for them to come together and talk. And if someone wants to join the group to find out more, then they can.
Yeah.
Because we are lucky that we already have these communities.
Yeah.
We're just not utilizing them as best as we can. We do great things like putting on Diwali shows and putting on all the festivities, but what about looking after each other's emotional health and well-being? Yeah. We could be doing so much more of that, because if these conversations are happening within our communities, then you're getting rid of that stigma. Yeah. And we are all helping each other and lifting each other up.
I think this is where this next generation can maybe be the catalyst for change, because even in the communities, the Asian communities that we've got here, I've started alongside another group of advocates and men and women who are starting to talk about and run these talks in the temples.
Amazing.
And trying to evoke conversation more than anything, because there's still a stigma there. The last one that I did was kind of pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
And I remember we did a blend. And, you know, I was really keen to do part of mine in Gujarati. I don't want to lose that language.
Yeah.
And people came, but you could see that they were hesitant to say anything because they knew the people around them.
Yeah.
So it's exactly what you say. It's about creating that safe space. But I also think, hopefully, in the generation that we are at, where we are more confident and, you know, I'd like to think some of my peers that are in a similar culture, you know, if my child came to me or I saw signs, I would actively say to my child, you don't need to talk to me if you want to talk to someone, if you need a break, if you know, if my child is saying they're constantly got stomach aches, I'm not going to, I would take them to a GP, but I would also think, is that a mask for something else? Is my child okay? How can I help them?
Yeah.
And put less pressure on them to feel okay and to now find and grow their toolkit.
Yeah.
Because what works for me may not work for someone else. But you only know that via trial and error.
And I guess what you're already doing is leading by example as well. So because your boy will see, this is what mum does, he's already picking up on all these things without you having to be prescriptive about it. And it can, you can do it in an unnatural way as well, where you tell your child what to do, but you're not actually doing any of it yourself. But because you're actually doing it, I think automatically that helps. I found that a lot with my parents. They instilled a lot of good habits from a young age into us. But because of this trying to fit in to with society, with cultural norms, I rejected a lot of it growing up. But luckily those seeds were still planted. And now when I need them, I can go back to all those practices and I've naturally come back to it. And now they're like, oh, now you're interested in yoga when someone else is talking about it. And I'm like, yeah. They're like, well, either way, we're just happy you've come round to it and you've come back to it and you can use that as a tool, even if it wasn't from when we told you from a young age, so you're still using it. So I think what you're doing is amazing already for your little one. And what you're doing in the community, by you sharing, you are already creating that safe space. And you said, yep, hopefully our generation. So people like you are making a difference, which is amazing to see.
And sometimes it has to be shown to them. And what I mean, and I remember the reaction because a lot of people contacted me after that last talk. And I did, I openly spoke about suicide.
Yes.
And it was a hard pill to swallow. And I had to, I remember I had to tweet this talk and I had to stay at the end. You know, I'm a fully functioning, working adult. I'm a mother. I have a full family. I have good health. That it's not one label or it's not, we don't need to just think of it. You know, we need to think of the world as dynamic. Everything doesn't have to stay the same. And I think for some of the elders that were there especially, they needed to see that that's not all there is.
Yeah.
It's not she was suicidal once and she saw his daughter. She's quite ill. It's, oh, actually she was ill, but she's got an all right job and she's fine now.
Yeah.
They need to know that it can be and that there are waves of change and that comes through education and access.
100%. Yeah. When I started psychiatry and I used to kind of talk to my mom about these things, that's how I found that I was able to, I feel like my parents were quite good in giving us good emotional health, but they're probably, my mom probably didn't know so much about serious mental illness. So I could tell her about, in a very confidential manner, about things that I was seeing. And then that actually opened up so many conversations between us. And she'd be like, oh, yes, in my childhood, actually, we had an uncle and he was really unwell and used to have shock therapy and all these things that she'd seen as a child, but not really understood because people wouldn't really talk about it, be a little bit hush hush. Or she spoke about an aunt that she'd realized actually had really severe OCD, but she'd somehow managed to kind of make it work for herself. But thinking back, she was like, God, she must have been really suffering all those times when people used to have to force a different routine on her. So again, it's just these conversations and not shying away from it and not being like, oh, if we talk about it, then it's going to happen.
Yes.
Or like, if we talk about it, we're giving our children permission that they're allowed to have these thoughts. Yes.
Oh my gosh, yes, I'm so sorry. So glad you said that, because that is a stigma that I am seeing so much in schools, especially with self-harm and suicide. And, you know, it doesn't matter about the culture. People are, you know, we can't say these words, because if we say self-harm, they will think about it and then they will self-harm. Mm-hmm. No, that's not the case. Actually, you're acknowledging their pain and you're giving them a space.
Yeah.
Because actually that brings it to the reality and it acknowledges it, but not with that judgment.
And that's it.
People who are in that level of pain need. They need someone to hold that space for them.
Yeah. And something you said earlier about how you felt when you had those suicidal thoughts, like, this is not a feeling that you just turn on or turn off. For someone to experience these thoughts, it has to get really, really, really bad. And it doesn't come out the blue. It's been building up for a while. And then it gets to a point where actually you think it's so bad that there's no point in being around.
Yeah. It catches on, as I talked about before, your senses.
Yeah.
If you're in a deep state of depression, you can't really taste, you can't really smell, you can't really hear or engage with the world. Mm-hmm. So it kind of feels like
you're a shell of yourself.
For me, this is my description of it at the time, and in my worst time. Remember, there was a point where I didn't want to shower because I didn't want the water to touch my skin because I couldn't feel my skin. That's such a strange thing to say. But that was the depth of what I class as my low, that I'd lost my senses. I'd lost, and not senses in mentally, as in my, you know, touch, smell, taste.
Make you feel alive.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. We did get to quite a nice upbeat part of the conversation because we were talking all about your recovery and I somehow managed to bring it to this. But that is the reality of this conversation. I think, again, it tracks what recovery looks like.
Yeah.
And you may have difficult time in your life where these thoughts may return, but you have a toolkit that you can go for. And you can help yourself and you can be more aware of when things are slipping, like you said, when you're feeling a little bit off, so that you can prevent these things from happening. But we never know. I have patients that are sometimes scared to be discharged from services. They're like, but Dot, what if like it happens again? And I said, well, the truth is life is going to be stressful. And I can't predict when life's going to get stressful for you. But if you hold on to this, everything that you've learned through your recovery and use that, then that will safeguard you from this happening again. But the truth is, I can't predict that it won't happen. And me just being here, knowing that you're going to have an appointment in 3 months' time, 6 months' time, is not going to prevent that from happening.
No.
It's the things that you are putting into place and you have been doing. So it's more, I like to empower them and remind them that the reason that you're here and we're at the point of discharge is because everything that you've been doing, and that will help. So again, that mental health journey, there's real highs and lows in it. And it's about building up that awareness, strengthening that toolkit, using all the support you have around you. And then if you feel like you can share, then you can actually start helping others with it, like you are as well. Through that journey,
it's about empowerment, it's about that person having a toolkit, but also eventually knowing that they know and care for themselves, just as they would care for others or significant in their lives. It's mental well-being is everywhere, isn't it?
It is.
We all talk about this self-love and, you know, but it is really about honing in on care. Well, in self-love, it's about care and kindness and empathy. That sentence that people throw around, you know, be kind, you don't know what others are going through. Yes, we're always going to slip. We are human. But to just live with a little bit more empathy and gratitude and a little less judgment, because we have no idea. Even if you've got a significant other, you still don't know exactly what your partner is going through.
Yeah. Yeah.
That changed things for me. That's definitely changed things for me.
That's amazing. We've covered a lot of things just naturally. It's like I said, it would have just come up in conversation. But anything else that you would want listeners to be left with, or any final parting words or any other topics that you think that we may have not covered?
I can't think of anything that I haven't covered.
No, you've been really, really generous with your sharing. It takes a lot of courage to come and share such personal details about your life. So you've done really well in doing that and listening to your recovery. I know exactly where it comes from. It comes from that part that wants to help others. But it's also gratitude, because everything that you're talking about, you're also expressing how grateful you are for the position that you are in right now. And I guess this is some part of your recovery too, sharing your story, your ongoing recovery. It's just amazing to see you at this part of your mental health journey. So again, thank you so much for sharing it. I know lots of people are going to find it very, very beneficial, because there's so many snippets in your story that people can relate to and take away and just feel that little bit less alone and think, ah, it's not just me that's gone through this. This might help me. This might help me. So hopefully that's what we can get. I know definitely we're going to get this from this episode. So thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
No, not at all. I remember when we did our initial meeting just to talk about what you'd want to cover, and I was almost in tears hearing your story. It was just so brave and courageous. Yeah. So thank you again. Tears today.
It's Friday night.
Yeah, we both held it together. Yeah. But thank you so much for sharing. And I'd love to have you on and we can do another topic, whatever it is, whatever you want to talk about. Yes, definitely.
Children's well-being.
Yeah, because I think that will be really useful for parents, parents-to-be, even if you're not a parent and there's nieces or nephews in your lives. Really, really useful to know. It's a hot topic, I think. What can I do to help my child's mental health? And
what can I do to help my mental health as well? Because
as a parent,
it takes a shift.
Yes, 100%. So let's do one around that. But yeah, that's excellent.
So that brings us to an end of another amazing episode. Thank you all for listening and supporting this podcast. If you would like to share your story on the podcast, please reach out to me via Instagram at Dr. Devika Patel, and I would be more than happy to have you as a guest on this podcast. Please subscribe and follow the podcast on your favorite streaming platform so that you can be notified when a new episode releases. My next guest that I'm going to be having on the episode is going to be Shocker, who is a rapper, and he speaks about his experience of recovery and living with schizophrenia. It is an episode that I have been really excited to record and share with you, and Shocker is just such a generous person in sharing his story. You will all be able to get an insight into what it's like to live with an illness like schizophrenia. So thank you again, and keep a lookout for the next episode.